My guest today returns to Ion Health. He's emergency medical physician with Medicine Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders. He's also a board member of MSF UK, keynote speaker and broadcast journalist. And it's a pleasure to welcome him back. That is Dr. Javed Abdelmenem. Hello and welcome.
Hello, good morning. Nice to be here.
Nice to see you. Now, as always, very busy talking about your experiences in the field. And you've worked in many places across the globe. Last time we met, I think you had been at Sierra Leone, is that right?
That's right. I was there for the Ebola epidemic. And in that same year, I had been in South Sudan in the post-conflict area. Of course, conflict ongoing at this stage, doing mobile clinics.
Now, you are a medical professional, a doctor. You work in emergency medicine in London. And you started this journey with Médecins Sans Frontières some years ago, actually, when you were young, a young doc.
Yes, I did. My first field assignment with MSF was in Iraq in 2009. That, however, was a full two and a half years after I first applied to them and they rejected me. And I was devastated because it was all I ever wanted to do. And they said, no, you're not experienced enough. Go away and get some more experience and come back. So I went away and did 2 more years training and finally got into the field in 2009.
Right. We're going to be finding out about those experiences with you, sharing the stories, really, to help people understand what's happening in the world to people and the work that MSF does across the globe. Now, since we last met, what have you been up to?
Gosh, quite a lot, actually. So it's been about 18 months. In that time, as you mentioned, I was a trustee of MSF UK. I've ascended to be chair of the board, so I'm going to be the president. I mean, that's the thing about MSF that people don't really know, is that we own ourselves. It's people like me who guarantee our independence. We decide what we do, where we do it, how we do it. And that's the beauty of MSF. We've got no other agenda other than, you know, giving healthcare. So I'm doing that. That's increasing role part-time. And in so doing, that meant that I had 2 field visits this year to Malaysia and Haiti. Our project in Malaysia is to try and ease the health burden on the Rohingya people, who are sort of the lost boat peoples of Southeast Asia, and to Haiti to visit our projects there, which I'll tell you more about later.
Well, let me share this little clip with you from Haiti.
Haiti, the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere, has been hit by a major earthquake.
It was already a disaster zone. And now this.
Earthquake in Haiti, say around 70,000 bodies have so far been buried in mass graves. And
on the 12th of January 2010, a massive earthquake measuring 7 points on the Richter scale struck the Caribbean nation of Haiti.
As the sun rose, the nightmare was only just beginning.
The hospital is collapsed, the national palace is collapsed.
They already had little here. Now many have nothing.
Haiti's worst quake in 2 centuries decimated the impoverished country and pushed an already fragile healthcare system to breaking point.
So that was back in 2010, and it's sort of a circle for you, isn't it? Tell me your journey and your connection with this.
Well, indeed. So as you heard there, the earthquake struck early in 2010, and at that time I was in Iraq, and you don't leave one assignment to go to another. But after I finished my 6 months in Iraq, I took a short break in the UK and went out to Haiti to help run the intensive care unit, the medical inpatient department, and the emergency room services in our little hospital that we'd taken over in a slum there in Haiti. The slum's called Cité Soleil, which means Sun City, but it's very much sort of gang central, the poorest area of the capital city, dangerous, violent, and you know, no water, no sanitation. So really a disease incubating place along with trauma. And I had a hard time. It was the first time I was truly exposed to so much disease, so much violence, so much death. And I firmly believe, and I know for a fact, that had those patients been patients in front of me in my hospital in the UK, the vast majority would have survived. And I felt it was so hard to have to, you know, when you, I wasn't given the resources and the tools that I knew I needed. And, you know, MSF can't do everything for everyone. And I was young, I was full of ideals and hopes, and I wanted to do everything.
And my save everyone.
Absolutely. And my supervisors, they had the strategic goals and vision, and they would say no. And I was too young and inexperienced to ask why and to help myself understand that no. And as a human, if you're given a no without an understanding of why, you find it hard to accept. So over months, I felt a growing burden of uselessness. I felt my patients were dying. I wasn't being given the tools. I couldn't. It was hard. One of the pediatricians in our team resigned. I ended up taking on that role. I had 7 children die 7 days in a row. You know, that's, you know, one of them I had just examined in my ward round. I literally put the child down, said to mum, all's well, turned to the next patient. I heard the mum yelp, turned back, and the child had arrested and died. And I was like, well, what am I doing? I clearly have missed something there that is not cool with anybody, let alone that mother. You know, so I had that, you know, this is difficult for your psyche. And then cholera came. And you know, if I say I'm well known for saying, if those first 5 months of my time there were a low grade attrition, you know, psychological warfare on my mental well-being, the last month when the cholera epidemic really crashed into Cité Soleil, into the slum, that was an onslaught. You know, that my defenses were already weak. I was tired, and then you are. One of the biggest markers or red flags for developing PTSD, for example, post-traumatic stress disorder, is a feeling of helplessness, a feeling of not being able to cope. And I had that with cholera, because no matter how hard and prepared we were, there were too many patients in those first 10 days, 2 weeks. We were, the minute you put a bed down, 3 patients went on the bed. We were building the beds. We didn't, you know, people were coming in wheelbarrows. People were being piggybacked in. It was overwhelming in all senses. And when I was, you know, I blame myself. I remember one night I went to bed. We were doing our day shift in the hospital, our night shift in the cholera tent. And I remember having to hand back a young 8-year-old to her parents, dead. And you have to clean the body and you have to fill the orifices with chlorine cotton. And that's quite graphic. And it was the first time I had to do that. And, you know, and I blame myself for her death, because I identified her as an at-risk patient before going to sleep for 2 hours just to make sure you can function. And I told the doctors and nurses, please, you know, keep an eye on her. Have a low index of suspicion for escalating treatment. And she slipped through the net and died in those 2 hours. And you blame yourself, as a human would. And you have to hand the body to that mother. And she's looking at you saying, I'm sure you tried. And you're blaming, you know, and that's hard.
It's really hard.
So Haiti was difficult.
And, yeah, and I know, having just gone back there in the last year, and we will find out how that was for you, because out of all the assignments, this was one of the toughest ones for you. But what you're highlighting for me there, Javid, is, you know, without MSF, you know, people, you're under a tremendous pressure, but you're there. Without this organisation, sending doctors in, regardless of where, as long as they can have access, is making some sort of difference, because lives are lost, but how many more lives would have been lost if there hadn't been the MSF presence? And what it does do is give us the true picture, the reality of what you and your teams are doing.
I firmly believe that, and that was for me even more obvious during the Ebola epidemic. And, you know, at that time, flights to the region were closed, borders were being sealed. It was just a very sort of keep that region at arm's length reaction by the globe. Nobody was there except MSF in those first months. Nobody. And for me, even though you couldn't provide a cure for your patient, it was expressed time and time again by the local staff, let alone the patients themselves, even the local staff, the solidarity of a human being coming and being next to you in the face of almost certain death, but just saying, we'll comfort you until the end. That is such a powerful, the solidarity, the humanitarianism of just being there. You know, it's, what else is there to do in the world if not care for somebody else?
Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, it's an international, independent, medical, humanitarian organisation. It delivers emergency aid to people affected by armed conflict, epidemics, natural disasters and exclusion from healthcare. We'll find out more of Javed's experiences when we come back. And we were hearing just then from Dr. Javed about his experience back in 2010 in Haiti. And I know he's returned to Haiti just in the last few months. A message came in here, Dr. Javed. How does MSF provide or initiate longer term support in Haiti? It's things like reforestation or rebuilding or doctor training.
Interesting. That's a really good question. I mean, that touches on development. And at the end of the day, essentially, MSF is about emergency medical humanitarian work. So we stray away from development intentionally. But in Haiti, I was really pleased to see that amongst the projects that are still there now, we never left Haiti after the earthquake. We have what are the highest level medical care for the nation, for burns, for obstetric surgeries, emergency cesareans, neonatal intensive care, and for trauma. So car accidents and gunshots and so forth. We have those hospitals still there all these years later. Actually, in the orthopedic hospital, the trauma hospital, it's so well established that Haitian doctors who are in training themselves, surgeons to do orthopedics and trauma, rotate into the hospital, get a year of super specialized training, and then can go back to the Haitian health system. And that's a training for Haitian surgeons, and that's fantastic. Sadly, you have to also recognize that the Haitian health system, as it is now, will never be able to provide the materials for those surgeons having learnt those skills to actually go and perform those operations within the Haitian system. But making that distinction between the Haitian system and the MSF hospital is neither here nor there. Our healthcare is free of charge for whoever comes, whenever, and we give it. So it isn't a parallel healthcare system, and it's definitely not a cost recouping system. Ideally, it would be lovely not to be there and develop Haiti along a model where everybody can have free healthcare provided by the nation itself. That's outside of our remit as emergency humanitarians.
MSF was started in 1971. It was a group of doctors in France, but it's grown. How many volunteers, how many members connected in the field with MSF?
Yeah, in the field we have roughly, depending on whether there's a huge emergency or not, about 11,000 staff, about 1,000 international staff, so foreigners working in a different nation, like myself, and then about 10,000 national staff. The ratio is roughly one international person to 10 local staff in the organisation.
You've worked in many places, Iraq, we mentioned, South Sudan. You also just recently went to Malaysia. Tell me about that.
The Malaysia project is super interesting, actually. I was there last month along with the Haiti trip. It's for the Rohingya. They're excluded, stripped of citizenship and afforded no rights in their home nation. And so they try to emigrate from their home nation and seek refuge and claim asylum. But in Malaysia, it's difficult to be processed as asylum seekers, and so they don't then have access to healthcare. So there we're patient advocates. We provide mobile clinics to actually give them healthcare in situ wherever they may be, and if they need referral for inpatient hospital stay, we refer them into the Malaysian health system, which is a very good health system, but that's needs money and it needs them to be registered as a refugee, and we then do that for them as their patient advocate. So it's a lovely niche project, a new way of working for us. After all, we have to adapt to the environment and really responding to an urgent need for the Rohingya.
Last summer, 2016, Javed embarked on a mission with MSF aboard the Aquarius. We're going to be hearing about that, what happened, helping people on board. People, refugees off the Libyan coast, trying to make their way, head out to some kind of better life, but understanding where they've come from, where they're going, and how at risk they are, and how MSF is helping them as much as they possibly can. So stay with me, Dr. Javed Abdelmanem, who is with MSF, that is Médecins Sans Frontières, and sharing his experiences on the field, helping people around the world, which is what MSF do. At any one time, there could be 50, 60 countries countries where MSF are present. And it's an amazing organisation. And we've posted up on our website today links and details for you to connect and find out more. Now, we met in 2015, about 18 months ago, and you've been very busy since then. Yep. You still do a little bit of work in hospital in St Mary's in London, yes. But MSF is taking over your world, which is good to know because you have such a passion and drive, and you are doing a lot of public speaking. You're also working in the media as well, yes. As being on the board, chair, no yes. less, which is amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you.
This caught my attention. It was on Instagram. It was something you did with Al Jazeera back yes. in 2016. It was part of your work remit anyway, helping refugees, people in crises, in migration. Tell me a little bit about the work you were doing then.
I was on one of MSF's search and rescue vessels. We have three on the Mediterranean, on the central Mediterranean route, saving lives, search and rescue in the sea, people moving from Africa through Libya towards Europe.
Have a listen to this.
Good morning. Bonjour. Sabah al-Khair from Aquarius. Under instruction of the Italian authorities, we have already commenced our 30-hour journey back to Sicily.
Breakfast time, and inside here there's a lot of activity. There is tea, bun and a porridge for everyone.
This man 7 days ago was beaten in detention with piping in Libya. He's got an abscess on his foot.
It's quite windy and quite choppy. It's only a 3 meter swell, but for a 1 meter high rubber dinghy that could have been very dangerous. It's causing lots of seasickness.
A lot of people making this journey have told me that they've experienced or at least witnessed physical and sexual violence, detention, kidnapping, extortion and forced labour.
We got a distress call from the captain. I wake up everybody. The SOS guys will get the RIP 1 and RIP 2 in the water, and that's how we start the operation.
I go on RIP 2 first. I give the safety instructions for the people, distribute life jacket and stay until the last person is safely on Aquarius.
I go out on RIP 1 to look at everybody on board. I select out the sickest, the women and the children, and take them back first to Aquarius.
Angelina, Mark and I stay on board Aquarius to receive all the people and look after the sick ones, while Boat 1 ferries backwards and forwards until the last person is rescued, and then Armani and Boat 2 can come back.
Because the people we rescue are only on board for a couple of days, I find that they are patients in transit, so I don't get to complete their treatment.
So listening to a rough edit there of the rescue mission, and this is part of, as you can sort of get an idea, of a huge mission. It's a daily ongoing, mission to rescue and to save people.
Indeed. I mean, it's a big logistical affair. It's remote medicine. You're on the sea in very difficult conditions in winter, and with people who have been kept in very, very bad conditions in Libya on the whole, who are not in the best of physical condition or health when they first get on that rubber dinghy. So for many reasons, it's actually quite a technical, logistical project. But at the end of the day, these people are on a rubber dinghy, which absolutely categorically has no way of reaching Italy. It is certain death.
So on the ship, you were saying it takes like 2 days, two nights on a fully functional ship in a dinghy, trying to make that journey.
I can't imagine how long. I really can't. I mean, there is no way. Firstly, there's not enough fuel given to them. If the dinghy, which is not seaworthy, doesn't get flooded by, a 1 meter swell is all you need. I mean, that's a normal day on the sea, let alone 11 meters. Mm. Or waves splashing in, or the dinghies themselves are made with very thin planks in the bottom, PDF wood. And when that snaps, which it does, the dinghy closes in on itself and collapses in. And the people in the middle parts of the dinghy actually get crushed to death, and that's a horrible death.
It's just, I mean, just to get an idea of the numbers here. So on that particular day, you rescued 169 people. 24 were female, 3 were pregnant, 3 had babies. There was one 13-year-old boy that was on his own that mm-hmm. you treated. Mm-hmm. This is in one trip, and these trips are going backwards and forwards all the time. Just to get an idea of I mean, it's bleak, but the fatalities of refugees trying to cross these waters.
I mean, Suzanne, that was one rescue, not one trip.
Yeah.
You know, we may make 3-4 rescues before then turning back towards Sicily, and it's coordinated by the Italian Coast Guards. And there are many vessels on the ship making those rescues. So over the Easter weekend just gone, there were 8,300 people rescued, 13 dead. Last year, the deaths were over 4,500. The year before, about 2,800. And these are the bodies that you find. They're not the bodies that sink, that disappear, that get washed out to sea. So we can't quantify exactly the huge number of deaths, but you know, it's still a good number, the bodies that we find. But to talk about how many are actually arriving in Europe, the port of call is Italy. The numbers are, you know, they arrive to the agencies, the UNHCR, the Red Cross, Save the Children, MSF, on land, you know, receive the patients, process them in the correct way for health and otherwise. Italy, for example, in the heavy months when the sea is calm and the smugglers send people out across the ocean frequently, Italy receives about 25,000 people in the summer months each month. And when I say about 16% of those people are children traveling alone, that's about 120 children a day arriving in Italy, having traveled alone from across the Sahara, from Eritrea. The boy you mentioned, that 13-year-old, he had a horrible fever and a rash, traveling alone from Darfur in Sudan, a volatile region. He didn't know where his parents were. I don't know how he got across the Sahara, how he paid, if he did at all, to get on that rubber dinghy, and where he thought he was going. He barely spoke English. I spoke to him in Arabic. I'm from Sudan. But You have a population of people who are leaving awful circumstances, be it persecution, be it economic, be it drought, be it famine, be it war, to try and find a better life. And then they end up in Libya, where there is a broken society at the moment, where there are traffickers, where there are people looking to make financial gain from these people's passage. And they are beaten, extorted, detained for months on end, raped. My very first patient on my very first rescue was a young Nigerian teenage woman who had been sexually assaulted by two men. She had all the physical signs of it, let alone the fact that she had left Nigeria to escape a sex ring and had fallen into detention and had been raped on multiple occasions, as she stated, over 4 or 5 months in detention in Libya. And you just, where they're coming from, what they experience in Libya, to then end up on the sea with certain death, it's a horrible situation.
And as you said, you're there really in this transit time, two days. Mm. So whatever treatment's needed, what kind of resources and how many of you are there on the ship, as in MSF, the support team?
Yeah. On Aquarius itself, MSF is a team of 6 or 7, between the logistician, 2 nurses, a midwife, a doctor, coordinators. Plus, there's also the rescue team, who get on the rubber dinghies, the rigs, to go out to pick up these people out of the water. Plus the sea crew of the ship itself. So all in, as a big crew, we're probably, it does vary, between 25 to 30. But we may take on 600-700 people in each, time that we're in the search and rescue zone. And then once we're full, we'll be instructed to which port to sail back in Italy by the sea, the ocean rescue coordination of Italy, the Coast Guard. And so it's a huge operation, because you have to feed those people when they're on board. Every human being on that ship will get a hand on by a medical person from MSF. We need to make sure they don't have fevers. So you don't want to be importing diseases into Italy. We need to separate the ones who may have infectious skin diseases like scabies that they've picked up in horrible detention centers in Libya. People come on with broken bones. I've had a man whose wrist was broken so badly it had set, he couldn't seek medical attention in Libya. A woman who was 7 months pregnant with a newly broken ankle. I don't know how that happened. So there's a lot of medical needs. We feed them. We give them a new set of clothes. They get access to a shower on board and toilets for 2 days. And then they arrive in Italy, and hopefully, we give them messaging. Listen, you know, it's not free access to Europe all of a sudden. You're going to be processed. Your asylum will be assessed, your claim to asylum. There's a chance you may get sent back, I'm sorry. But at least you'll be safe. At least you won't be beaten. At least you won't be raped in Europe. But we do try and align their expectations. It's not the golden heaven that you think you're going to be getting to, but at least it's safe in Europe.
Well, looking at the MSF newsletter, and just to, you know, get this in perspective, I mentioned before there could be 50, 60 countries that MSF are supporting. So, you know, there are crises and issues and problem across the globe. Just looking at your newsletter this month, April, Ethiopia, thousands hit by outbreak of acute diarrhea. In Mali, there's not a single crisis. There's an overlap of crises that adds up to a chronic crisis. That's one of the stories. Nigeria, testimonies of forced return. Another story here regarding Iraq. We walked all night, staying away from the roads for fear of being caught. Just to give you an insight, our paediatric hospital had to function as an adult trauma centre. That's coming out of Iraq. South Syria, a family returns to a village battered by war. Just to give perspective on this, it's not one single country. It's not political. As an organisation, you're not political. It's about humanity and providing aid where it is needed. Now, people are sending in their questions. We're going to address them when we come back. One including the idea that organisations like MSF are doing more harm than good by going in and helping countries. So we'll share that message in full and hear what Javid has to say. Reflections from the field, emergency response from Haiti to the Mediterranean, Médecins Sans Frontières, Doctors Without Borders, MSF invites you and a guest to an evening in conversation with Dr. Javid Abdelmonem. And it's been a pleasure having Javid here. It's not over yet. We'll be giving out details where this event is happening later this evening, and we've posted it up on our blog post today as well. Always fascinating to talk with you guys from MSF and the work that you're doing across the globe. Now, a message came in here, and I'm sure people might, you know, that this person isn't alone in being concerned. So they're saying MSF and charities like this exist, and actually it's causing countries to fail because they can't plan for their own disasters. Their existence is one of the root causes why countries can't cope in the first place. It's a self-perpetuating vicious circle. The charities' times would be better spent ensuring countries are prepared to cope with disasters. What do you say about that, Javid?
I would agree wholeheartedly. And you may say, why is he agreeing with that? Well, that's because MSF is a charity that is about medical, humanitarian, emergency aid. So if there is an epidemic, we will go and treat patients. Now, to teach that country or to build resilience in that country, to develop that nation, to have their own structures and their own ability to deal with that epidemic in the future is outside of our narrow remit. That will be developmental aid. That will be about good governance, rooting out corruption, you know, health information systems, health structures.
Economics.
That's, you know, outside of what MSF tasks itself for doing, where doctors will treat patients. But that person is right. The reason we don't have these out of control epidemics in Europe is because we have that good governance and health structure and the money and the will and the knowledge to do it. We've developed ourselves. There are charities that are to do with development. So if that person is so keen that those charities are built up and stronger, by all means support those charities. It is equally important. It is more important because that will be, as he says, the final answer to mean that we don't exist.
And you're not needed.
Wouldn't that be a wonderful world if MSF was not needed? Wouldn't it?
And it is about that, isn't it? There is a need, and as human beings, the humanitarian side of your belief, your value system, is to help where help is needed. Yeah. Now, as a doctor, as a medic, that's what your oath is. That's what you pledge as when you enter the medical profession. Doctors Without Borders means it doesn't have to be in your own country. It is across the globe. It's not about the politics. It's about the human being. And as a doctor, if we can help, we will be there and do our best to help.
Absolutely. We will, you know, and until that need is not there, we will continue to aim to meet it. But that need not being there requires all the things that this person mentioned. It needs development, good governance in nations. And we haven't tasked ourselves with that because we're doctors. That's somebody else's job and they need to get on with it. Because actually, yes, 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 one day that will be the answer. And these things need to happen in parallel, though. What are we going to do? Ignore the need until it's fixed? Well, as we're finding out, it's an ongoing, decades-long, maybe centuries-long process. And until then, we will do our best to help that man, that woman, that mother, that daughter, that husband from dying.
Message here, very inspirational. What have you learned, Dr. Javid, about people in the field, when you've been in the field? So whether it's the people you're treating or meeting or working with?
Do you know, it's a good question. The more and more of this I do, a patient is a patient. Pain is pain. Fear for your child's life is fear for your child's life. It doesn't matter how rich you are, how poor you are. Disease doesn't care. It doesn't matter where you live, what religion you are. A car crash will hit you. You know, the human body will fail. Every human being on this planet is exactly the same in a doctor's eye. And that gives me hope and courage, because we all have the same hopes. Our hopes are to live a good life, to care for our children and to plan for their future. Isn't that a fantastic thing? So then you say, well, why do we have wars to kill each other? What is going on with the human race? So then I get a bit despairing. But really, when you boil it down to that interaction between a healthcare provider and a healthcare seeker, we're absolutely physiologically down to the last cell, and on that higher emotional level, the same. It doesn't matter where you are. And I love that.
We started off this hour talking about you in the field in Haiti back in 2010, and you've been on many missions across the globe in the past years with MSF, and that was a tough one for you. You talked about that. You talked about how, and if you have just tuned in and want to hear this hour in full, it will be podcast in the next hour or so you can pick it up on our website. But you went back recently, and things have changed within the MSF organization over the years, and one thing you have hinted at was, you know, the pressure on the volunteers when it comes to their mental health, dealing with the stress of being in the field and some of the things you experienced in Haiti in 2010. But now you're telling me that volunteers have the support, there's more support there for them, for people like you, to deal with what you do every day.
Yes, MSF has woken up to the issues of mental health. We are, when we go into the field, national staff and international staff, we're often in difficult contexts. We might be in fear for our bodies through Ebola or being bombed, and we're in difficult circumstances, as I said, in Haiti, where we're faced with with a task that feels overwhelming, and that leaves you prone to mental ill health. So MSF, always, even back then, we had access to counselors as volunteers, but it was an active process. I had to recognize that I had mental ill health and trigger that help. I didn't recognize it. I was naive. I was inexperienced. And it hit me many years later, the difficulties that I had. I had to put down my stethoscope for 5 months. I couldn't work. I was really burnt out. Now MSF is so much better. We have a flying team of counselors that visit projects to open. Staff and their family can go and seek counseling for whatever reason. We have a linked counselor in our operational centers that we meet on the way out and on the way back. Hey, how are you? How was it? Tell me about your difficulties. We're much more proactive in making sure the mental health of our workers is taken care of, because mental health is as important as physical health. And of course, Western healthcare is really predominantly fixated on physical health, but mental health is there. It's a huge component.
And what's next for you, Dr. Javid?
Oh, the world. No, what's next for me? I intend, as always, to do a short mission in the summer. So I will do that. I don't know where. I'll take on my new role as the chair of the Board of Trustees in MSF UK. That will bring with it greater responsibility and also a little bit more control of what MSF does and input into the debates and discussions about how we operate and where, which I really enjoy. I'll keep, you know, I'm going to keep within MSF that. I'm actually starting to do a little bit more TV presenting, which is fantastic. I've got back in the UK some BBC and Channel 4 series coming out. So let's see where that goes. But always, you know, for me, my heart's with MSF.
Well, keep doing the good work that you do and the team of volunteers with MSF. People who might be interested, they may be not medics, but are looking to volunteer internationally. What advice would you give them?
MSF has got a huge variety of roles in it. You know, for every medic that is at the interface with patients, behind them there are logisticians, there are water and sanitation engineers, there are psychosocial counsellors, there are nurses, there are laboratory technicians, there's admin staff, there's security staff. There are so many different roles that back up behind that medic in MSF. So do your research, look on the websites. They give you very clear and precise criteria about what qualifications you may need and what roles we're seeking, and tick off the requests and apply. It's a very easy process thereafter. It may be difficult to get the qualifications, but it's an easy process thereafter. And by all means, support us. You know, there are even positions for volunteering inside MSF offices, you know. So there are many ways to help.
For now, thank you very much for your time, and do come and see us again when you're next passing through the United Arab Emirates. For now, Dr. Javed Abdulmonem, thank you so much.
Suzanne, thank you. It's been a huge pleasure to be here. Nice to see you again.
Thank you so much.